If anyone wants the four boons, Artha, Dharma, Kama, Moksha, he should do the seva of the sadhu. This is the Bhajan Charapadarat on page 156. If anyone wants to finish the pain of birth and death, he should always chant God's Naam in his heart. If anyone wants the glory, he should leave the egoism in the company of the saints. If anyone is afraid of birth and death, he should take the shelter of the saint. Nanak sacrifices everything for those people who are thirsty for God's darshan. If anyone wants the four boons, Artha, Dharma, Kama, Moksha, he should do the seva of the sadhu. Bhajan of Guru Arjan Dev on page 156.
Char padarat je ko mange, 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 sadh jan ki seva lage, 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 jeko apna dukh mitave, jeko apna dukh mitave, jeko apna dukh mitave, jeko apna dukh mitave, har har naam rid sar gaave, 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 jeko apni soba lo de, 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 sad sang ho om sho 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 de, jeko janne am maran didare, 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 sad jan ki sharni paade, 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 jis jan ko prab darsh piyasa, 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 nanak ta ke bal bal jasa, nanak ta ke bal bal jasa, char padarat je ko mange, 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 sadh jan ki seva lage, sadh jan ki seva lage, sadh jan ki seva lage, sadh जनकी सेवा लागे.
Anyone is afraid of birth and death, he should take the shelter of the saint. Nanak sacrifices everything for those people who are thirsty for God's darshan. I'm going to read from my latest book, The Years with Ajay, Stumbling Toward God, The Years with Ajay, which is now at the printers and, God willing, should be out by the middle of November. Many people, many, many people have asked me about it. Up until now, I have been very uncertain, but that is the word we've got from the printer. So this section is about my visit with Sanchi in September 1982. It's called The Higher Calling of Our Lord, which is a title that I took from Bob Dylan, who wrote a song with that name, which I happen to like very much. And it coincided beautifully with the way I felt about the trip. So, in September 1982, I returned to India to see Sanchi again. Major changes had taken place. The master had moved his ashram from village 77RB, the 77th village on the RB Canal, to village 16PS, the 16th village on the PS Canal, where the underground room in which he had meditated full-time during the last years of Kripal's life under his direction and guidance was located, demolishing the 77RB buildings and moving the bricks to 16PS to reconstruct them. He never fully explained why he did this, but the property had been made available to him many years before by Sardar Ratan Singh, the village landowner and a long-time devotee of Sanchi, for the purpose of full-time meditation, at which time he, Ratan Singh, had constructed the underground room, which played an enormous part in Sanchi's spiritual consummation. From then on, visiting the underground room toward the end of the stay was a major part of every group's experience. The other major change was this. Sanchi's eyes had given him trouble for years, dating back to his excessive weeping at the time of Kripal's passing, and possibly before that. After the 1980 tour, he underwent eye surgery in Delhi, and from then on wore glasses consistently. I was, as I mentioned below, apprehensive about the effect this would have on our receiving darshan, a good part of which was looking into the master's eyes. But in fact, it had no effect on that. The following section is based on a talk I gave in September 1982 on my return from Rajasthan. And I have a footnote. This trip was memorable for many reasons, one of them being that John Bice of Bakersfield, California, whom I had never met, had the bed next to mine, and we became great friends. John, now deceased, was a Jungian psychotherapist, very much in love with the master, who became a mentor and therapist to many a satsangi. He was the group leader in Bakersfield for many years. Oh, I wrote, a group of us, including me, have just returned from 10 days with Sant Ajay Singh in Rajasthan. This was the first group this year, so I will try to convey something of it. I decided to keep a journal this time. It didn't last long. I kept it 2 days. But my first entry just reads in capital letters, written on the night we arrived just before I went to bed. Tonight I have come back home. That was the way it was. We drove in, jumped out, and there he was, sitting there. And the second I saw him, I realized once again I had forgotten completely what he was like. I don't know why I never seem able to learn this particular lesson, but nonetheless I was absolutely astounded at how beautiful he was. He was sitting on the platform, elevated, with gas lamps burning. He had his glasses on, and he looked absolutely beautiful in them. I used to have worries. If the master is continually wearing glasses now, how on earth are we going to have good darshan? But I saw right away that it was nothing like that, that we were going to have great darshan, and that it was not going to be a problem at all. We just sat there and drank deep. He was radiating light and love and beauty, and we were getting it in waves. I had occasion to discuss with Michael Rayson, who was also in the group, the fact that exactly 13 years ago, that is in 1969, we, along with several others, shared a trip to Master Kripal's feet, a trip which changed my life. We left America this time, the same day that I left in 1969, and there were many other correspondences. And on that trip, too, I remember walking into the Master's house on the first night, seeing him, and realizing that I had completely forgotten what he was like. I remember writing to Judith on that occasion, "The pictures don't get it, the movies don't get it, nothing gets it. They're all lies because his face is totally uncapturable in those ways." And I remember also writing, "After looking at that face once, how can we ever do anything mean or petty or silly again? It's a good question, and I still wonder it, because there it is. We're given this, but we don't seem able to retain it very long." Sitting there, I knew, as I have known many times before, that I was sitting at the one place in the universe that was worth sitting at, and I was doing that which above all else I was born to do, sitting at the feet of the God-man. And it wasn't only a question of that night. It continued on day after day. And I may add that the Master is in excellent health. He is radiating love and joy and positivity. Not that he ever doesn't, but last year there was a definite difference which manifested itself in a lot of different ways, including my private personal experiences too. Somehow or other, the Maj, the will, has changed. There is nothing but upbeatness now. The trip was one continuous lesson on a lot of levels for me, and I suspect it was for everyone. There did seem to be a theme that repeated itself over and over again, the theme of protection, that we need not worry. We discussed the Sermon on the Mount in Satsang a year or so ago, and I remember that we spent a lot of time on the theme of cosmic helplessness, that when we recognize that we can't do anything ultimately, then we trust, we put ourselves in the hands of He who can. The question of forgiving others is tied up with this too. We don't need to worry about exacting vengeance. We can let go of that and forgive them, just as we are forgiven. And this question of trust, which is what is really meant by faith, this question of trust, of putting our hand in the Master's and letting Him lead us, has been hard for me. It's true that I've been with Master for so many years, but certain things are hard for us to learn. We may get the same lesson over and over again. I remember when Judith and I went to India for the first time in 1965, Master Kripal said to me, "How is that karma book coming?" That was the Wheel of Life which I was printing then. That was the first book that we ever printed here. And I said, "Well, there's a lot of problems, Master." And Judith said, "He always worries that he's doing it wrong." And Master said to me very seriously, "Look here. If you are traveling in a train and you insist on carrying your suitcase on your head, what is gained by that? If you put the suitcase down on the floor of the train, it will go at the same speed you do. You don't have to carry it on your head." That's the lesson, you see. That's the point. The Master does take care of things. He's competent, and he has our interest at heart. And the basic element, the foundation of trust, is to accept the circumstances of our life, whatever they may be, as the best possible beginning for whatever we have to learn. That includes the conditions that might prevail, for example, at the ashram in Rajasthan when we're there. It may include any circumstances that we find ourselves in. I'm not saying that we never have to improve them if they can be improved. But the point is, as Master Kripal wrote me many years ago, please know it for certain that whatever comes to your count is in your best spiritual interest. And that's a hard lesson. I had problems with it this time too, and the Master showed me over and over again without my asking. Just to show you in a very minor way how things work out at the ashram and how our best laid plans can be frustrated, I always like to sleep in the corner of the dorm for privacy. I like to keep away from the hustle and bustle, comings and goings. They have a porch now built around the dormitories, and it's really quite nice. I liked it a lot. It means that in the hot weather you can put your bed under the porch roof and you don't have to pull it back and forth continually from the room to the courtyard in order to be outdoors. It's cooler during the daytime, and if it rains, you're all right. So I saw that right away and said, oh, great. And I took a bed and put it into the corner in my usual way for privacy. It wasn't until all the beds were filled up that I realized that that bed was right next to the bathrooms. There were 5 bathrooms, and one of them was just 1.5 feet away from my bed. The others weren't much further. So I thought, well, this is all right. There are certain advantages. Sometimes I have to go and it will be close. So we won't worry about this. But wow, instead of being in the corner, I was in the absolute center. All of the activities of the first 3 days centered around those bathrooms, it seemed, and I heard it all. I was aware of everything. It was something else, I will tell you. And I thought, well, we can only manipulate so much. We're so clever, we know exactly what we want. We want the corner, so we get the corner, and the corner isn't what we thought it was. Now, one of the members of our group was Debbie Smith from Vermont, a sweet lady who was 8 months pregnant, and when we got there, it looked for a while as though she just might give birth, and this sent me into a tailspin. I was lying there on that bed during the first couple of days worrying about whether she was going to give birth or not, worrying that if she did, it would be my fault for not having tried to dissuade Judith from letting her come. The group did include Carol Feynman, a midwife, interestingly, Master always works like that, who let me know that, yes, there was a very good chance that she was going to give birth. The next day she had contractions. Wow, I asked her about every 5 minutes how she was doing. That afternoon, though, Sanchi went to see her, and he told her that everything was going to be all right. And he was very glad she had come and other very beautiful things. Her morale went shooting up sky high, and so did mine. Of course, she didn't give birth, and she didn't even have any more contractions. The whole time that we were there, she was absolutely excellent. She had a marvelous, marvelous trip, and she told me the day before she left that she wouldn't have missed it for anything in the world. It was a great lesson to me. The Master is in control, and he does make things happen when they are supposed to happen. I realized again that it is a question of trust. So much agony we can spare ourselves if only we can trust. And if it doesn't turn out the way we think that it should, even then we can still trust, because we don't necessarily know what the best thing is. One of the Sevadars there was a man I have mentioned before in satsang. Some of you know him and some of you will remember him from years back, Mr. A.S. Oberoi. He has been a friend of mine for many years. An initiate of Baba Sawan Singh, he was a very close Sevadar of Master Kripal. He was one of the principal architects of the Unity of Man Conference, for example. He told me a story which illustrates this whole point of protection, the way that the Master works, better than almost any story I know. It's connected with his son's death. His son was in his 30s, a grown man and a lawyer, and he died in an accident while Sanchi was in Delhi, recuperating from his first operation a year ago last spring. Sanchi was seeing no one during this period. He was at Papu's house, but he had bandages over the one eye that had been operated on, and he was not giving darshan or holding satsang. He was simply resting. The doctors had told him that it was of the utmost importance that he rest absolutely, or his eyes would be damaged, and he was not under any circumstances to exert or go out. So Mr. Oberoi said he got a call from Papu's sister. She said Sanchi wanted him to come and bring a book of Master Kripal's Hindi discourses that had been recently published in Delhi. Sanchi wanted to be read to from that book, and he wanted Mr. Oberoi to bring it. So Mr. Oberoi and his wife agreed that it was really a great honor to be invited to come at this time, so they procured a copy of the book and they went to the house. The first thing they saw when they walked through the door was a copy of that very same book lying there. One of Papu's other sisters said, "Oh yes, Sanchi is read to from that book all the time." So they thought, "This is strange. There must be something going on here." Anyway, the master sent for them, and in the course of a jolly, loving conversation, he asked them about their son. They said that he was doing fine, and he said very strongly, "The master will take care of him." Then the subject changed and they went on. Mr. Oberoi told me that the way Master said that, "the master will take care of him," stuck in his mind. His son had a strict schedule that he regularly followed, which involved his working till 9:30 at night. He was invariably home by 10. But on this particular night, 2 days after the interview with Sanchi, he didn't come home by 10, and he didn't come home by 11. By 11:30, Mr. Oberoi was calling the hospitals to see if something had gone wrong. His son rode a motor scooter to work, and the fifth or sixth hospital that he called said, "Yes, there is someone of that description here. You'd better come right down." He wouldn't say anything more. So he and his wife went down, and their son was dead. He had been in an accident and died instantly. And the man in the hospital said, "Yes, he was dead when he was brought in." So they asked, "Who brought him in?" And the man looked very strange and said, "Well, that's the funny part of it. The man who brought him in was an old Sikh man. He had a white beard and a turban and was dressed all in white. And he was carrying him in front of him in his arms. The son was 6'3" and weighed 200 pounds. So holding him in his arms like that took incredible strength. So he put the body down, and when we looked around for him, he was gone, and we never saw him again. We don't know who it was." Mr. Oberoi and his wife immediately went to Papu's house, and they went upstairs to where Sanchi was. He told me, "The first thing I noticed was that there was a very strong breeze blowing, but that Sanchi was sitting there absolutely drenched in sweat and breathing very hard." Oberoi fell at his feet and told him what had happened, and Sanchi looked at him and said very strongly, "The one who carried in your son's body is not unknown to you." That was all that he said and all he would say, but from that time Mr. Oberoi has felt absolutely convinced of the Master's protection. He said that at the funeral also, someone who should have known better made a reference to this tragic death. And Oberoi said that at that point he was inspired, and he got up and said, "This is not a tragic death. A death when someone is taken by the Master, is put under his protection and taken up, cannot be and is not tragic. This is the beginning of his liberation." Later he told Sanchi, who had against the doctor's orders attended the funeral, but had left before this happened, what he had said. Sanchi told him, "Well, no one was there to say what I would have said, so you had to say it." I pondered this a lot. It was a miracle, but what happened as a result of the miracle? Nothing was altered in God's will. The person did not come to life again. He was not healed. But instead, the Master showed the people who loved him in an unmistakable fashion how he watches over and takes care of them. There's no way that that can be discounted. Once this is understood, you see, our commitment can become complete. I think this sort of thing is often missing in our devotion. It's as if we feel, well, we trust the Master, but certainly I've often felt that way. But if we see, really grasp, that Master is taking care of us, he is watching over us with the express and specific purpose of enabling us to grow in the way that is our destiny to grow, then what can hold us back? Another aspect of it is this, the acceptance of our destiny. When we say to the universe that we are through fooling around, an image I have used a lot in the past, we are committing ourselves to whatever the universe then wishes to deal out to us, because whatever we have accepted will lead to our growth. This means that our destiny is different than it would have been if we had not made that commitment. Our ultimate destiny then is very high. It carries a lot of implications with it, and we don't generally, I don't anyway, act like that destiny is really there. We act like, well, just like anybody else. Part of that we can't help because we can't grasp. It's not possible for us to grasp the implications of our real destiny, so we are shielded from it to some extent. But we've got to grow up sometime and know that the Master has called us to a high calling, the higher calling of our Lord. And we have to press on in that. It's now appropriate for us to walk on and on, closer and closer, deeper and deeper into the love of the Lord. And it's there waiting for us to penetrate it. If a lot is demanded of us in the meantime, if we are given greater responsibility and greater, well, isn't that what happened to the Master also? And did he want it? We have to be aware that the other side of the coin of seeking is finding. When we find, we have to be able to accept the implications of that which is found. And if what we find is indeed ultimate truth, then that carries with it ultimate responsibility. And now is the time to begin, I think, preparing ourselves for that. These are things which I have had a lot of trouble with, and that's why I bring them out. But on this trip, Master talked to me a lot about this. He told me to be strong. That's nothing. Everybody's supposed to be strong. But the fact is that I'm often not strong, precisely when I should be. And sometimes I let things happen that I shouldn't let happen because I want to be a nice guy. I don't want people to not like me. I want to be all things to all men, as St. Paul said in another context. But Sanchi told me, no, be careful and be strong and do what has to be done. It's your responsibility. This is something that we all share. We are all called to be children of God. That's our calling. We may have different ways of working that out, but the calling remains the same. When the Master initiates us, he's giving us the passport. That's the term Kabir uses in the Anurag Sagar. He's giving us the passport so that we can begin our journey. And our job is to continue the journey. I think that the Master's insistence that when we go to India, we should go directly to him and also go directly home. Master Kripal mentions this in morning talks also. This is what a true lover will do. Sometimes people have a hard time with this. They've got a lot of irons in the fire. They want to do other things too. India is a fascinating place. The Taj Mahal is there. Monkeys, elephants, the Himalaya mountains. I've seen all these things, so I'm not perhaps in a position to judge anybody who wants to see them. I enjoyed them. But the fact is that when the Master says this is the way it should be done, there's a profound reason for this. It's like a paradigm or epitome of the spiritual journey. Because if we start out on our journey and go here, there, and everywhere, and in the course of time we end up at the ashram meandering along, and then we drift back home afterwards, we are laying ourselves open to things. There was a lady on our trip who refused to obey this, I'm not blaming her. I doubt that she fully understood the point. In any case, she didn't pay any attention to this request of the master. She went over early and did the tourist thing in India, and as a consequence, on the day of the journey up to the ashram, she got terribly sick. She thought she was going to die. It's not that she was being punished for disobeying the master by getting sick. That's not the point. The point is that it is for precisely that reason that the master issues those instructions. He doesn't want us to be wide open to anything we might pick up. The physical thing is only a parable of the spiritual, and illness is the least of it. These things are very real. When the master lays these things down, they are to be paid attention to. It's the same way on the spiritual journey, too. We have to move along fully recognizing that the end of the journey exists. In other words, we are really going someplace. We're going from the edge of our soul to the center, and that involves responsibility. We had a very sweet session on the Saturday night before the monthly satsang. After supper, we went into another courtyard where the Indian Sangat was already gathered. We joined them and sang bhajans. Sanchi was on a very simple dais, a chair on a wooden table, and just beaming love. Mr. Oberoi told me the next day that an old initiate of Sawan Singh who was present told him that the way he sat on the platform radiating love and happiness and jolliness was exactly the way Baba Sawan Singh used to do it. At that session, to illustrate that the master does take care of things and we don't have to worry, Carol Feynman told me that she had worked hard to prepare a bhajan, and it was a hard one too. Meto Kripal. Being separated from Kripal, I wept. Sanchi's bhajan, really hard to sing well. And I should mention that anyone who doesn't, had never participated at Sanchi's ashram in a bhajan session with the Indian Sangha, that as Sanchi said, he used to tell us this, that it's not a question of him pointing and telling someone they could go. It's people jump in right at as fast as they can as the previous bhajan is finishing up. Usually the first line of the new bhajan and the last line of the last overlap. It's always very hard for me to ever get one in that way. Anyway, Carol had prepared this bhajan. She'd wanted to sing. She'd worked on it, and she was sitting in the audience wondering if she should sing it or not. She was praying to Master, "If you want me to sing, let me know." And she looked up at Sanchi sitting there, and she said suddenly he was totally and completely Kripal Singh on the dais. And the second she saw that, her arm went up as if it were on a string, and he looked right at her and nodded. And she started to sing, and sang it very sweetly too. The moment it was over, he commented on it. Obviously he had that in mind. The whole thing was work to bring that about. So the master has very powerful things in store for us if we trust him. After all, as Jesus said, if your father loves you, he won't give you a stone if you ask for bread. How much more will the Heavenly Father not do that? We're always afraid, I'm always afraid, that we're going to end up with stones and hungry. That's my fear, but it's never happened yet. So these things may be deep-rooted in us, but still, our calling is to trust. And I want to conclude reading a brief section from a talk that Sanchi gave in Vermont in 1977. And I'll give a little background on that. The full day of the stay here, and this is in what is now Wauwatosa in Vermont, featured the blessings of Samhain. A steady downpour of rain came all day. As I explained earlier, the satsang was scheduled to be held outdoors, and there was no tent or anything. It was just going to be outdoors. Later on in the stay, they built a roof so that this wouldn't happen again. It was impossible to hold satsang as scheduled, as the only available place was outdoors. There were three times as many people as could fit into the largest available room. So the master held satsang three times that day, three full-length satsangs, an hour each, one after the other, for one-third of the sangat each time, so that no one would miss out. Later in the stay, a tent was erected and satsang was held there when it rained. All of those satsangs, which the master delivered with great good humor and tremendous power, were extraordinary. But the first one, which was later published with the above title, was specially extraordinary. Above the title was Only Devotion and Love. It has remained in my heart ever since. And he quotes the hymn, "In the court of the Lord, only devotion and love are counted. Only devotion and love. The Lord is pleased by devotion." And Sanchi says, "Paltu Sahib was a famous Mahatma in the place called Ayodhya. He was a merchant. His family pundit's name was Janaki Das, and he was a very spiritually minded person. Paltu Sahib had the yearning to realize God right from his childhood. So once he asked Janaki Das, 'What have you learned from the Vedas and Shastras and what you are preaching to others? Are you doing that? Have you realized that God?' Paltu Sahib thought that since this man is talking about God, it means that he has known God or has realized God. Janaki Das was a very good soul. He was born in a pundit family, but still he did not feel good about the business doing the business of a pundit because it was a deceiving business. So he told Paltu Sahib, 'Truly speaking, I am not impressed by this family business, because I am very much confused. What I am telling people to do, I am not doing. And I also have a yearning to realize God.' So he joined Paltu Sahib and they both started searching for a man who would help them to realize God. Once they heard that a famous Mahatma, Gobind Das, had come. Both of them went to see him thinking that he was a very good Mahatma. People were coming to him. That meant he would have realized God. But when they approached Gobind Das, he said, 'I only have initiation of two words, and that is not the complete goal. God is not there, God is still ahead. I am still searching, I am visiting one village after another.' He also wanted to realize God, even though he was a Mahatma of a lower stage. So now there were three people who had the yearning to realize God. They decided that they should go in different directions, and whoever found anyone who could help them realize God, that one would learn from him. Then whoever got that knowledge would come back and teach the other two people also. So they all began to search for God. Our master used to say, 'Demand and supply is the law of nature. There is food for the hungry and water for the thirsty. Nature always quenches the thirst of the thirsty and always supplied food for the hungry. At that time, there was no living master in the body, so Bhikkhu Sahib was ordered from Sachkhand, though he was not then in the body, to go and give initiation to one of them. He appeared as a man and initiated Gobind Das, who was taken right up to Sachkhand. In that way, he became a saint from the very beginning of his initiation. Then he initiated Paltu Sahib and Janaki Das. So Paltu Sahib's guru was Gobind Das, and after his initiation he meditated, and he also became a perfect saint and started preaching Nam. At that time in India there was the Vairagi sect, which believed in idol worship. Many people followed them because they were teaching people to go into the temples and do the worship of God. Paltu Sahib spoke fearlessly about God, and he was giving the knowledge of Nam. Many people were attracted to him. He feared no one. When people became attracted to him, the Vairagi people were afraid. 'Now he's going to stop our business.' They opposed him so much that they burnt him alive, because they were envious of him." In this small hymn, Paltu Sahib explains to us, by giving very beautiful examples, that in the court of God only he receives a place who has devotion and love for God. In that court there is only love and devotion. God is pleased with him who loves him and is devoted to him. Now the question arises, how can we have love and devotion for someone whom we have never seen? We can love only that person whom we can see and feel something for. We have never seen God. How can we claim we are loving God when we have not even seen him? We are not loving our fellow beings whom we daily see and with whom we deal. If we cannot maintain that love, how can we have love for that God whom we have never seen? In the first line of the hymn, the Lord didn't accept delicious food, but gladly ate the poor food of the Shudra. Now Paltusab says that God loves only devotion. When he comes into this world assuming the body of a saint, he never looks to people's caste or social position, whether someone is a king or a beggar. In ancient times, the town of Delhi was called Mastinapur, and the Pandavas and Kauravas were ruling there. When they started fighting with each other, Lord Krishna wanted to go there to mediate between them and stop the war. They were cousins, and Lord Krishna thought that if they fight, the world will experience a great loss, because they were the entire ruling family of India. Duryodhana was king at that time, and he was very proud of his kingship. He thought, I am a very important person, so Lord Krishna will come directly to my house. But there was one servant, or Shudra, named Vidur, and a Shudra, of course, is the lowest of the four Hindu castes. He was a devotee of Lord Krishna, and he also had the desire that Lord Krishna should come to his house. And even though Duryodhana was proud and thought, Lord Krishna will come to my house, Krishna didn't go to his house. Instead, he went to the house of Vidur. Vidur was not at home when he arrived. Vidur's wife was there, but she was bathing. When Lord Krishna called the name Vidur from outside the house, she was mad in the love of Lord Krishna, so much so that she even forgot to put clothes on her body. She came out of the bath completely naked. She was not even aware of her body. Lord Krishna told her, crazy woman, you are not even aware that you are naked. Go and put on your clothes. Lord Krishna came into the house and sat there waiting for Vidur to come. Vidur's wife wanted to serve Lord Krishna by giving him food, but there was nothing in the house except one banana. She took that banana out from the cupboard and peeled it. But instead of giving the fruit to Lord Krishna, she gave him the skin and threw away the fruit. But Lord Krishna didn't complain, and he ate it. When Vidur came in, he saw that his wife had given the skin to Lord Krishna and had thrown away the fruit. He rebuked her, "Have you left your senses? What are you doing? You've given the skin to God and have thrown away the fruit?" She brought another banana, and he peeled it, gave the fruit to Lord Krishna and threw away the peel. But Lord Krishna replied, Vidur, the sweetness that I had in that peel is not in this fruit. Then she cooked vegetables for Lord Krishna but forgot to put salt in them. Lord Krishna ate that dish and never complained. But when Vidur ate that food, he was very upset. He said, what has happened to you? Have you gone mad? First you gave the skin to Lord Krishna, and now you are not putting salt in the vegetables? What's wrong with you? But Lord Krishna told him the next day, oh, Vidur, you don't know the sweetness of that vegetable which she made for me. That vegetable was sweeter than kheer, rice pudding. She made that vegetable with so much love, and when I ate that vegetable made with love, it was very helpful to me. I spent all night in meditation. Because of that love and the sweetness of the vegetable, I was able to meditate for a long time. Next morning, when Duryodhana came to know that Lord Krishna had stayed overnight at a Shudra's house, he was very upset. He spoke with Lord Krishna very sharply. You don't like our palaces? I know you went there to eat very sweet, delicious food because they have very sweet things for you. But you didn't remember that they are of low caste. They are not people of our caste. But Namdev says God never looks at the caste. He looks only at the love and devotion. And Sanchi goes on to tell two more stories on the same line. And one of them, first one, was the story of Shivri and Lord Rama, which we all know, I hope, extremely well, since both Sanchi and Kripal told that story around 100 times. And Sanchi also included it in several bhajans, in which the yogis got a very strong lesson about the holiness of someone who may treat it with total contempt, namely Shivri, the low-caste black woman that they considered was totally worthless. And it turned out she was the holiest of them all. And he also told the story of Draupadi and the banquet in Supat Sudarshan, and how he was finally managed to be invited to the banquet in order to perfect the miracle that they required. And the talk ends with this line, Paltu, no one should be proud of his high caste. Only love and devotion are counted in the court of the Lord. Now Paltu Sab says, if you have this thought in your mind, that you are a very high caste, or you are a rich man, and that's why you will get God. Or if anyone has this thought, that he is a low one and not a wealthy one, so he cannot do the devotion of God, they should not think like that, because God is pleased by love and devotion only. Guru Nanak says, the place where the accounts of our deeds are going to be checked, at that place neither our body nor our caste nor our name or fame will go. Bhula Shah says, your caste and your name and fame will remain in this world, and only your deeds will be counted there. Nobody is going to tell you, you are a Sikh, so you come in the first row, or you are a Christian, so you go back, or you are a Muslim, so you come from the other door. This is not the case, but only our actions are going to be checked there. Kabir Sahib says, nobody is going to see your caste. One who is meditating on the name of God, only he will get God. And those who are doing his devotion, they become his form. We should always remember that no matter how pathetic and how trivial and how silly our efforts may seem to us, that if they are motivated by love, then, you know, they are counted. It doesn't matter how badly we do them. If the love is there, just like Lord Krishna felt the love in the banana peel, and he was able to eat it, and in the unsalted vegetables that were sweeter than rice pudding. Remember always that he is our advocate, our defense attorney. When we come up for judgment before the Lord of Judgment, Dharam Rai or Kal, the Master is there to present our case. Not that it necessarily happens literally like that, but that's cosmically, that's the name of the game. And the Master prevails. And if we, you know, if we trust him and have that love for him, then that carries us through 100,000 mistakes. And remember also, both Kripal and Sanchi quoted many times, if you take one step toward me, I will come a million steps toward you. That's sometimes as fewer numbers, I mean, sometimes 100 steps. But the Master wrote me way, way back when I was first on the path and had made many mistakes and so forth. He wrote me, if you take one step toward me, I take a million steps toward you. And that's what's required, that one step. And that step is our love, our devotion. If we have that, it colors everything else. And we, you know, we can all have that. We don't have to be super intelligent or super energetic or super discriminative. All we have to do is love, and that too carries us through everything. So that's the great, great gift of the Master, that he gives us that love, and then uses it to take us through. Tremendous paradox. But then everything about the master and his path is a paradox. And you remember also that as initiates, we are the luckiest people in the world. But we are not the only ones. Everyone will be an initiate someday. And Master loves everyone. He loves those of us who are already put on the path. He loves all those who want to be put on the path, but for one reason or another, it doesn't work out. And he loves all those who don't care a fig about it, because they will someday. He is truly speaking, as Kripal said a number of times, a universalist in every sense of the word. Every human being, every animal, every plant ever made counts. It's all part of the deal. And they, every one of them, every one of us, will all be liberated one day. And remember, it may seem like it takes eons and eons for that to happen. And it will, from our point of view. But from the Master's point of view, it all happens in a split second. Just like that. It's done. And that's the way he sees it. And that's the way it ultimately really is. But from our point of view, yeah, it takes forever. But if we can remember the Master's point of view, then we can be greatly relieved. So it's a great, great thing, this path of the Masters. You know, at times it may seem like only a few people are involved in it, but then we see, you know, it's not like that. You know, there are two incidents that I've mentioned a number of times. One was in Ghana, in Africa, in 1977. We were going on an all-day journey to this great government-established estate that was served as a picnic place. People went there and spent the day there. And this whole caravan of satsangis went out from Accra, the capital, where we were staying. And we got to the gate, and the gatekeeper wouldn't let us in. And, you know, Nanako argued. He said he couldn't because we didn't have permission. But Nanako told him, no, we did have permission. He had gotten permission definitely. But the gatekeeper said, well, nobody told me, and my job is to keep people out unless I know they have permission. So Nanako was desperate. We had, whole Sangha, including the Master, had come all that way. Now we would have to turn around and go back. So he told the guy, well, look, this is a master of the highest order. Please take a look at him and try to understand what he is, and please deference to him and let him in. And the gatekeeper looked at Sanchi, and he looked, and he looked, and he looked, and he said uncomfortably, well, he's very beautiful. And Nanako said, yes, he is. And the gatekeeper said, well, all right, because you're so beautiful, basically, he didn't quite say that, but that was the upshot of it, I will let you in. And he did, and we had a very sweet time. The other incident took place in New York City in 1980, 3 years later. We had just arrived. We were staying at the home of Mr. James Nicholson, whom some of you will remember. James' brother Hercules was in the hospital. And they were Greek people, that's why Hercules had that name. And we went to see him. James took Sanchi to see him, and I went along with Papu and so forth. And we went into the, we got there after hours, and the doctor didn't want to let us in. But Mr. Nicholson said to her the same as Nanako had said to the gatekeeper in Ghana. You know, this is a God-man, and he really wants to see this disciple of his who needs to see him badly. Please look at him, etc. And the woman doctor looked at him. She was young, and she was a very lively person. She looked at him for a long time, and she said, well, he's very beautiful. I will certainly let him in. So that Sanchi went in, and Hercules was dying. He died a few days later. He was overjoyed to see the Master, and they had a very, very sweet darshan. But, you know, later I was thinking, Here are these two people who are as far apart from a worldly point of view as you can imagine. Different continents, different skin color, different level of education, different social standing. And both of them, when they were brought face to face with the master, were so overwhelmed with his beauty that they forgot everything else and went by that. In their own way, that was the devotion and love that Paltu Sahib is talking about. It overwhelmed everything else. Their sense of him, what they were able to see, their beauty, his beauty. It's the same with us. You know, we look at the master, we see his beauty. The video this morning, he was so beautiful. You know, it's true that I said earlier that the pictures don't get it. Some of them come close. That video came very close. Just think, how can anyone be so beautiful? How can it be? It's the master's love that is coming that allows us to think like that, allows us to see his beauty. Someone else who doesn't, you know, who's not into it, might not see him that way at all. But there it is. So his love makes our love possible, as Master Kripal used to say. Our love is reciprocal, or his love is reciprocal, I don't know. But the fact is that it's a two-way street. And his love makes our love possible. And that's a very wonderful thing, which we can all be very grateful for. A closing bhajan is Duk Bhanjan Tera Naam Ji on page 173. Your naam is the pain remover. Meditate day and night, 8 watches. This is the knowledge of the perfect Satguru. The within in which Parbrahm dwells is the beautiful place. If you sing the qualities of God with your tongue, the stones of Yama will not come near you. With my understanding, I don't know how to serve you, nor do I know the ways of worship. The life of the world has your support. Oh, my Agamdeep Satguru, when God becomes gracious, all the worries and problems go away. The hot wind does not affect, as Satguru himself protects. The master is God, and the gracious one is the guru, and master is the true creator. When the master is pleased, one gets all the things. Nanak sacrifices himself on such a one. Your naam is the pain remover. Bhajan of Guru Arjan Dev on page 173.
Dukh panjan tera naam ji, dukh panjan tera naam. Dukh bhanjan tera naam ji, dukh bhanjan tera naam. 8 pehre aaradiye puran sat guru gyan. 8 pehre aaradiye puran sat guru gyan. Puran sat guru gyan ji, dukh bhanjan tera naam ji, dukh bhanjan tera naam. Jit ghat vase par brahm, soi suhava thaan. Jit ghat vase par brahm, soi suhava thaan. Soi suhava thaan ji, dukh bhanjan tera naam ji, dukh bhanjan tera naam. Jam kankar nede na aavai, ras na har gun ga. Jam kankar nede na aavai, ras na har gun ga. Ras na har gun gao ji, दुख भंजन तेरा नाम जी, दुख भंजन तेरा नाम। सेवा सुरत ना जानिया, ना जाने आरा, सेवा सुरत ना जानिया, ना जाने आरा, ना जाने आराद जी। दुख भंजन तेरा नाम जी, दुख भंजन तेरा नाम। ओट तेरी जग जीवना, मेरे सतगुरु अगम अगा। ओट तेरी जग जीवना, मेरे सतगुरु अगम अगाध, सतगुरु अगम अगाध जी। दुख भंजन तेरा नाम जी, दुख भंजन तेरा नाम। भाए कृपाल गोसाइया, नठे सोग संताप। भाए कृपाल गोसाइया, नठे सोग संताप, नठे सोग संताप जी। दुख भंजन तेरा नाम जी, दुख भंजन तेरा नाम। धरती वाओ न लागई, सतगुरु राखे आप। धरती वाओ न लागई, सतगुरु राखे आप, सतगुरु राखे आप जी। दुख भंजन तेरा नाम जी, दुख भंजन तेरा नाम। गुरु नारायण दास गुरु, गुरु सच्चा सिरजनहार। गुरु नारायण दास गुरु, गुरु सच्चा सिरजनहार, सच्चा सिरजनहार जी। दुख भंजन तेरा नाम जी, दुख भंजन तेरा नाम। गुरु तूठे सब किच पाया, जन नानक सद बलिहार। गुरु तूठे सब किच पाया, जन नानक सद बलिहार, नानक सद बलिहार जी। दुख भंजन तेरा नाम जी, दुख भंजन तेरा नाम। दुख भंजन तेरा नाम जी, दुख भंजन तेरा नाम।
When God becomes gracious, all the worries and problems go away. A hot wind doesn't affect, as Satguru himself protects. The Master is God, and the Gracious One is the Guru, and Master is the true Creator. When the Master is pleased, one gets all the things. Nanak sacrifices himself on such a one. Your Naam is the pain remover. May God bless us all.